We learn from the situation of Moshe Rabbeinu that even though there was a great calamity in the mission of the spies, nevertheless, that did not deter him from utilizing that approach again when it came time to attack Sihon and Og. Because rather than just wash your hands from the whole thing, which many people do, after they've had a bad experience, some people just say, that's it, I'm not going to do that thing again, as opposed to others who take a rational approach and analyze what the factors were and determine, well, maybe you still can deal with that type of thing, but what you need to do is to make the corrections. That takes a more rational, flexible approach. And people who refrain from doing that are much more restricted in life. Because it's inevitable that that's the way life is. There are many things that you could derive benefit from or even pleasure from, but that the first time out, it could be a disaster. Or things can go wrong. But that doesn't mean to say you just wash your hands from the whole thing. By taking that approach, by allowing it to affect you that way, you're very restricted. Now I can't, as I gave an illustration with camping, a person can go out camping, and the first time everything goes wrong. Everything falls apart, it rains, this, that, the heater didn't work, and so on and so forth. So many people allow that to affect them emotionally. It's sort of like a bit, maybe even a superstitious kind of thing. Like that's not for me. It's not for me. And for years, they won't do it. Other people can have the exact same experience, think it over, and try it again. Trial and error, and learn what the mistakes were, and develop the ability to do it properly, and then they're very happy now. They have an additional thing in life that gives them pleasure. Moshe Rabbeinu analyzed the situation. The difficulty, the danger in the first mission of the Meraglim had to do with the fact that the objective was to seek out information about the resources of the land. The purpose was to strengthen, to give fortitude to the will of the people, to uplift them about the goodness, the material aspects of the land. That was clearly part of the mission. And of course, therein lied the whole danger of the mission. And in fact, that's the Chazal that sort of criticizes the idea. Depicts God as saying, I told them that it's good. They should have relied on that. Once that became a component of the mission, and it's clear, because Moshe instructs them in the charge to see the nature of the land, the fertility of the land, and so on and so forth, bring back report, and even this Chazaktem, strengthen yourself and to bring back the fruits of the land. Once that became the case, it's a different kind of a mission, in addition to military information, and that's why you had to have 12, because a spying mission shouldn't have 12, and it was a public phenomenon. Therein lies the problem, it was a public phenomenon. So it left open the door that if things did not go well, then it would have a terrible effect. However, this doesn't mean you can't change the reality. The reality is that when you go to war, you need good intelligence, good information. So the next time Moshe went to war against Sihon and Og, he needed the information. However, he learned the lesson. This was a purely a spying mission, in which it's private. By definition, spies are supposed to be private people. No one's supposed to know who they are. So of course Moshe Rabbeinu sent out spies. That makes perfect sense. And you can't draw any conclusion from the failure of the first mission, which was not a classical spy mission. I did raise the question, however, pertaining to Yehoshua, which I think is a good question. And that is, Yehoshua now, 40 years later, is preparing to enter into the land of Canaan. And God has told him. He's doing everything at the behest of God. And that God is going to be with him. And no one will stand up before him. Nevertheless, we do see that he sends out spies. Now, I don't have a problem. I'm not asking that question. But why would he take a chance with spies, given what had happened in the case of the Meraglim with Moshe? Because we've answered that question already. You learn from the mistake, and you don't repeat the mistake. The military aspect was definitely appropriate. However, I'm saying, why was there a need for a military mission at this point in time? I think that's a strong question, because they had already accomplished that. the military aspect had been taken care of. There's just two aspects that you're concerned with. Either the military is the primary. If you have other things you want to find out, material nature of the land, that also was accomplished. Question I'm asking is, what was the purpose? What was the necessity behind for these Meraglim? Because they already, it seems to me, had received all the military information from the first mission. It was suggested that perhaps you needed updated information. That's not a bad idea in general, but my sense, I have two problems with that. First of all, we're talking about a situation in those days where you didn't have that kind of particular, you didn't have satellite photos and all of that. It was more of a general kind of thing. The fortified cities, that didn't change in 40 years. The roads that we should take or avoid, those kinds of situations, you didn't have rapid change. I think that the kind of information that they required, they pretty much already had. And bearing in mind that a spying mission is always risky, it's hard for me to understand that it was necessitated by that factor. However, there is a proof from the story itself, I think, to support my point that it wasn't for that kind of military information. I think if you went through the chapter, there's something in there that would support my claim. In point of fact, if the objective was to obtain that kind of military information, one wonders what were they doing in the house of Rachav, which is going to be a question anyways. And doesn't seem they got much further than that. They just went to the house of Rachav, and then they left. They had to escape. So they didn't spy out the land, and there's no indication that Rachav provided them with any kind of military information. So therefore, it's clear then, from the story itself, as well as from the issue that I raised, that there was no real need for military information. Thus, what was he searching for? It's also interesting to note, it's not clear to us why they chose to go to the house of Rachav Hazonah. Because what are spies doing in a place like that? They should be out spying. However, this does lend support to the notion that the mission was not geared towards the specific military installations, things of that sort. Because if that's what you're looking for, why go to the house of Rachav Hazonah? It seems to me that there are two factors which motivated the mission of Yehoshua to send out spies. It was pointed out at the beginning that perhaps it's 40 years later and the situation has changed. Now, my response to that was that from a general standpoint, the general kind of information that they were seeking, I don't see that it would change in 40 years to any significant degree. However, there was something which changed, which would, in my opinion, affect the situation. There is a practical difference, however, and that is, even if you study the story of the Meraglim, it doesn't seem that the inhabitants of the land at that time were aware that the Jews were planning to invade. They sent them from Kadesh. And they do make reference to the fact that they were seen. They traversed for 40 days and 40 nights. You didn't have this element of tremendous secrecy, and they even brought back fruits from the land, which they had to carry on poles. It was so big, the fruits. And then they do say that we saw the giants, and we were like chagavim, we were like grasshoppers. We felt like grasshoppers in comparison. They used that analogy to make it appear how, you know, powerful and frightening they were. And so, too, that's how we looked to them in their eyes. Apparently, they were seen. And nothing happened to them. So, therefore, it seems to me that the land that they witnessed was not in any kind of a state of alertness and preparation. That is to say, the people in Canaan at that time didn't know that they were planning an invasion. So that's one situation. And that gives you what's called the element of surprise. In war, that's a very significant factor, the element of surprise. So every nation, if possible, you don't always have that possibility, but whenever possible, if you are planning to go to war, you try and do so in a manner of surprise. We've seen this in our own times, in recent history pertaining to Israel. Where's the element of surprise coming through? A big factor. Interestingly enough, Israel used it in the Six-Day War, even though Israel was surrounded on three sides, and one would have thought that how can you have an element of surprise? They were surrounded on three sides, and the Arabs were claiming that they're going to wipe them out. Nevertheless, Israel, through operating intelligently, was able to create an element of surprise, because at that point they brought in Moshe Dayan, who was then, they made him the Minister of Defense. He was the great Israeli war hero. And when he first, at that point there was this tremendous tension, and the Israeli people were getting nervous, because they were surrounded on three sides, and they sensed that the government was a bit weak and tentative. So they brought in Moshe Dayan to restore confidence. His first remarks were that we've lost the element of surprise, so it's too late. It's too late to launch an attack, and it's too early to give up on diplomacy. So he created the impression that at this point in time we have no choice because we don't have the element of surprise. That's passed us by, and they were involved in negotiation with diplomacy, going from different capitals to try and get it resolved through diplomacy. So that was his answer. That was his policy. But that was camouflage. Of course, this was reported throughout the entire Arab world, and they took him at his word, and they relaxed their guard. They didn't know that plans had already been made for a surprise attack. The very next, within hours, they launched their surprise attack, and they achieved the element of surprise because the Egyptian pilots were going out on their ordinary morning exercises, thinking they had plenty of time, and the Israeli warplanes were swooping in and just knocking them out. They achieved one of the greatest military defeats of all. Simultaneously, all three enemy countries, their airfields was struck, and they virtually destroyed all the enemy air forces. And without an air force in desert warfare, you're finished. And that led to the tremendous victory of the Six-Day War. Element of surprise. So sometimes you can pull out the surprise by telling everybody that there is no surprise anymore. That was a utilization of chachma, of intelligence. Unfortunately, Israel suffered from the element of surprise itself. You have to always be careful, though, that when you have a tremendous tactic and you use it against your enemy and you achieve a tremendous victory, you always have to be careful because they learn the same tactic. And the same tactic can be used against yourself. In 1973, this situation was reversed. And there's many factors I'm not going into right now, but for whatever reason, the Egyptians utilized the element of surprise, the same type of camouflage, and Israel did not have ample time to protect, especially the Suez Canal. And in the end, they were able to pull out a victory, but a tremendous downfall. It was a tremendous loss. And it was very dangerous at a certain point. They simultaneously attacked from the Golan, and they simultaneously attacked along the Suez Canal. It's a fascinating chapter in Israeli history. Element of surprise. So I would say it seems to me that in the case of the Meraglim, they did have, so to speak, an element of surprise. Because they were not poised to attack. They were encamped in Kadesh, and they sent out 12 spies, which is a lot. It's very dangerous against someone who's preparing, who knows you're coming, and it seems that they were able to traverse this as they traversed the land. And they didn't get caught. In the case of the spies of Yoshua, they got caught immediately. However, perhaps this will explain to us why Yoshua needed to send out spies, because it's a different situation now. It's one thing to attack a country which is not expecting it. But at this point in time, it's 40 years later, and the Jews had kept moving. And it was pretty obvious to everybody, as we see from the story itself, that they were very scared, but they were also on guard. The gates were closed and locked. They knew Beth Sichon. They knew that the Jews were marching through the lands and coming closer to the Jordan, and it was clear to everybody that they were prepared for the invasion. If that's the case, then my question is removed. Then they would definitely need to send out the spies to discover what preparations they've taken in anticipation of the assault. That was not the situation of the original mission. In the original mission, they just wanted to know in general where are the cities, the fortified cities, the roads, etc. That doesn't have to change. But the new situation is now focused more in terms of the particular preparations that they've taken in anticipation, because we've lost the element of surprise. That's one change. There is, however, another factor. And I'm directing everybody to Bamidbar. In Matos, you have this very interesting episode. The story of the two tribes of Reuben and Gad. Later on, it was half the tribe of Manasseh as well. After they conquered the lands on the other side of the Jordan, so that was tremendous land, a tremendous amount of land, and they were very, very good for grazing, for pasture, for grazing. And these two tribes say, hey, this is terrific for us. Can we take our inheritance on this side of the Jordan? So they came to Moshe with this proposal. And they described the benefits. And then they made the request. If we found favor in your eyes, so let this land be given to your servants. It's apparently, nobody else really wanted it. And it was a huge amount of land, and it was more vulnerable, because it was on the other side of the Jordan, other side of the Jordan. But the tribes of Reuben and Gad were very, great fighters. They were powerful, and they were courageous. And so they're saying, let us have our inheritance on this side. Well, when you read this story, they make their request, and Moshe Rabbeinu responds with harshness, and he accuses them of intimidating the Jews, that this kind of behavior is going to have a tremendous effect, that it's going to destroy their spirit, because they're going to think, essentially, they're going to think that, why are you staying on this side? Because you're afraid, because you don't want to join the battle. And once they see, and then he refers back to the incident of the Meraglim. And then, why does he have to recount for them the whole story of the Meraglim? I assume they knew that story. He basically pretty much equates them to the Meraglim. Ko asu avoseichem. He says, this is exactly what your fathers did when I sent them from Kodesh. That is to say, they acted in a manner which led to the breakdown of the spirit of the Jews. This is very, very harsh. He launches a attack against them. And then he repeats what happened, that God got angry, and God swore that none of these people would enter the land, except for Kalev. He repeats the entire history. And take a look at the conclusion. V'hine kamtem tachas avoseichem, and now there has emerged, in the place of your fathers, Tarbus Anashim Chatayim, a group of sinful people. He's talking about them. That this is it, you're Meraglim too, so to speak. He concludes this with the accusation that they'll turn away from going behind God, and God will have to continue to keep them in the desert, and you'll destroy the entire nation. That's very, very harsh. But nevertheless, in response, they come forward with their proposal. And they say that, well, we're going to build cities over here and places for the animals and so on and so forth. We'll leave our families behind. And we'll go forward, fully armed, in front of Bnei Israel. That is to say, their response is very, very forthcoming. They're very forthcoming. They said, we're not going to do that. We're not just going to abandon the Jewish people and let them fight and avoid that. We'll fight. We'll join in the fight for the land. What we'll do is we'll leave our families and everything behind. They don't just offer to fight with them, but at the head, the vanguard of the attack. And And they go, look at Yechez. We won't return home until the Jews, each one of the Jews has received his inheritance, which means we're not just going to be involved in the battles and so forth. We're going to wait. We'll stay there until the entire mission is completed. Then, in response to that, Moshe says, oh, I'm tossing a davar hazeh. The whole tone changes. It turns out it's not, according to this first answer, you think, forget about it. Well, there's another instance you can learn from Reuven and Gad. I think that's an important lesson. Because a lot of times people have a question, and they think it's a sincere and a legitimate question, and sometimes for whatever reason, you may ask the Rebbe or some rabbi, whoever it is, and you may catch him at a bad time, and there may be some misunderstanding, and he may get really upset. How can you even ask such a question? This and that, you know. Now, very often, again, you're faced with the same dilemma. Maybe I shouldn't bring it up again. You know, you sort of run away, retreat, apologize. Or sometimes you think it over, and you say, one second, I don't think you really heard my question. And you don't want to go back and start in again, but that takes courage to fight for your point. Life always demands a certain type of courage. And there's the fear, well, maybe I'll just make a bigger fool out of myself. Oh my God, what's this person thinking of me? You don't want to lose your face, so to speak. That seems to be the most important thing. Everybody wants to preserve his face. But sometimes, look at Reuven and Gad. They had the courage to come back. And now Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, oh, if that's the case, fine. If you're willing to do that, fine. The question that I'm asking, though, is, it does seem then that they had honorable intentions. Now, why, when they raised this issue, so apparently Moshe was not completely against the idea. He was against the idea if you're not going to join in the battle. But if you're going to join in the battle, so then he's willing to go along with it. So why did he first have to condemn them? He seems to have condemned them for just making the proposal. In these kinds of situations, if I make a proposal, which is okay, makes sense, but the only thing is, there's another factor that if you do this, it can create a separate problem. So you have a right to point out to me what that other problem is, and then see how I react. What Moshe had to tell them was that, one second, you're making this proposal, but which is not a problem in and of itself, but you have to take into consideration all these other factors and give them a chance. He doesn't do that. He simply condemns them. Then, we don't understand why. If they were that kind of people, if they were that Tarbus Anashim Chatoyim, they were a group of evil people, okay, but they're not. What I'm getting from this is, I think Moshe criticized them because their question displayed a lack of sensitivity to the realities, to the historical situation that they were in. That is to say, sometimes it's legitimate. I have a proposal, which is a decent proposal. I make it, you know, but you point out to me that there's other consequences that will flow from that. You're not angry at me. You just, well, I hadn't thought about it. That's one type of situation. Because how much can you think of? You know, that's why you discuss an idea with somebody else. They'll say, yeah, it's all right, but you didn't think of that angle. Oh, you're right, I didn't think of that angle. Then you're not going to get angry at me. You're just going to see can I deal with that angle? Can I address that issue or not? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't take that approach. He might have taken the approach and said, okay, because in point of fact, their being on Eva Hayyadim was not the issue. That's okay, but look at the effect it's going to have on the Jews. So why didn't he simply say, well, fine, it's all right, but I have to take into consideration how they're all going to perceive it. You don't have to get angry at them at this point. Then if they say, well, you know, the Jews shouldn't have this, you know, if they deny, if they fight with him on that point, then he can get angry at them. But he gets angry at them right away. So it seems to me that there are certain cases where the very fact that you yourself didn't think of it, that's the problem. That's the problem. How dare you? How can you come to me and be so focused on your own particular needs, your own situation, which is what they're focused on? It's great for us. It's the cattle. You're totally involved in your own material fantasy over here to the extent that you didn't think of it. You didn't come up with it. What about the effect? You have to be fully aware of the very history we're living. Where are we coming from? We're coming from 40 years in the wilderness. Where does that come from? That comes from the Chet HaMeraglim. And what was that? That was an intimidation. A sense of intimidation which was brought about by the report of this overwhelming might of these people. That's so sensitive, that's such an issue, that that doesn't go away so fast. That's something which is transferred from one generation to the next. True, that generation passed away, and this will be a new generation, but this is the children of the parents. And this leaves a mark. This leaves a scar, and it gets passed down from generation to generation. We say this all the time. In all of the Slichos, and on Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, we say that we're not azepanim. We say we're not people of chutzpah, arrogant, that we come before you and say that we didn't sin. Aval anachnu v'avoseinu chatanu. But we and our fathers have sinned. We always make reference to the fact that we and our fathers have sinned. Because there's two aspects of sin. There's our own contributions, our own human creativity in the realm of sin. We add things, but we inherit. Let's face it, to a large extent, just things be out of your control unless somebody points it out to you. Certain attitudes are built in from your parents, your upbringing, and so on and so forth that you don't even question. So therefore, that's a danger. They had been left with a certain impression. They knew that they sent out spies, and they knew that this entire generation could not enter the land because they were seized by a certain type of a fear. And that was expressed in those words, the report. What were the most damning in my words in the report? It seems to be that whole thing about the grasshoppers. That we saw the giants, these are mighty people, the giants were like grasshoppers. Not only that, interestingly enough, there's two aspects of that pasuk. Because they should have simply said that we felt like grasshoppers in their presence. That wouldn't have been so bad. But they said, V'chein ha'yinu b'yeinehem. And that's how they looked at us. Oh boy, that's very significant. That's very, very dangerous. Just because you feel insecure and weak and inferior, you have one... See, you should always remember you have one tremendous asset in a situation where the way it looks to you, like, how am I going to move these people? You always have to know one thing. That's how you feel. But you're still an unknown to them. They don't know how you feel. So if you communicate a certain sense of weakness and insecurity, that's a killer. But if you don't, if you can control that, and you can display a certain sense of confidence, then that could have a tremendous effect. I think that's why Moshe was extremely harsh with this thing. That they were blameworthy for just simply negating the harsh effect that this would have. You have to say that the memory of the Meraglim had not been removed. Otherwise, why would Moshe be concerned that you're going to bring up that whole thing again? We're going to have the same problem all over again. We're trying to get past that, and you guys are going to bring it up again because, oh... They'll say, well, why would the Jews even say a thing like that, that they're trying to avoid the battle? Only because of the history of the Meraglim. Now, if you'll notice, right before the sending of spies, when Yeshua gets prepared, at the end of chapter 1, from Pasuk Yud, from 10, he gives out the orders. Yeshua gives the command to the officers to pass throughout the camp and to command the people to prepare provisions, because in 3 days you're going to cross the Yarden. So now he's undertaking preparations for the invasion. The next thing we read about is he summons Reuven and Gad, and now you mentioned the half-shaved Menashe, and what does he say? Remember that which you promised Moshe, the servant of God. That essentially he repeats the promise that you're going to leave your families behind and you are going to lead the charge in front of your brothers, and you're going to fight with them until the mission is complete and until all the Jews have inherited their place, just like you've inherited your place. So this is extremely important. This element over here becomes extremely important. The fear, the danger that they still might have inherited this attitude that intimidated the parental generation, because they were left with the sense of the overwhelming might of the inhabitants. And that was the report. That was the report of the spies. Which means to say that it was damaging, not just in the immediate sense that those people were afraid to fight, but it becomes part of the whole history of the nation. Because that's the image that was left with them. And the mere fact that they were punished, true that they were punished, but it doesn't matter. Like, the children are going to wonder, why were they so afraid to fight? Must be something. So to eradicate that image, what existed in their minds was a certain image that their parents had about these people. It's true that they should have had faith in God and they shouldn't have been concerned about that image, but nevertheless, that image was still there and was a danger. So you see that Yeshua, again reaffirms the promise of Reuven and Gad. Now it's the Chatzi Shevet Menashe. And the very next thing, and what do they respond to him? He gets their response. And they answered, "Kol asher tivtzeinu na'aseh," that the promise is still in effect. Whatever we promise, we will do, and wherever you send us, we'll go. And they're affirming that they accept his authority just like they accepted Moshe. Just like we listen to Moshe, we'll listen to you. But only let God be with you, as he was with Moshe. And any person who rebels against you and will not listen to you will die. Rak chazak v'amotz. They charge him to be strong. And then the very next thing is, he sends out spies. So it seems to me that this is a solid foundation. The mission of the sending spies is directly connected to the mission of affirming that he's not going to have a problem with the two tribes. Because if he has a problem with the two tribes, he has a problem with arousing that fear. The rekindling of the fear in the children, which we have to be concerned that they inherited from their parents. And so now it makes sense to say what was suggested before, that perhaps his objective was to eradicate that. That had to be uprooted. They had a faulty notion they had inherited. He had to do something to counter that, to eradicate that, to demonstrate to them that that was false. That that was a false image. And unfortunately, it was something which had been concocted by the Meraglim. The Meraglim did not really know the true state of affairs. The image that they presented was false, as we're going to see from the actual information that they received. Thus, for these two reasons, it now makes sense, in my opinion. Thus, I think that the mission had two foundations, two causes. One, from a practical standpoint, the situation had changed. That is, in the time of Moshe, they were just looking for general military information, but there wasn't the point was not that the people were prepared, what type of preparations they'd taken for the invasion. That didn't exist at that time. However, now, 40 years later, and given that the Jews had continued to move and were on the other side of the Jordan, they were poised to invade after defeating Sichon and Og, there's no question that the inhabitants knew that an invasion was imminent. So now you want to know what measures they've taken. Secondly, it was also to try and ascertain the state of mind of the people, because the attitude that had been inherited from the generation of the Meraglim, that sense of fear, that sense of power, that was something that they were still concerned about. As we see in the reaction of Moshe. Moshe's reaction would not have been the same were it not for the incident of the spies, because he tells them that you're just doing exactly what the spies did. And Yeshua, before he sends out the spies, ascertains that he's not going to have a problem with these two tribes. So I think it was rooted in those two factors, and that's why it's unlike an ordinary spying mission, and that's why, interestingly enough, they don't spy out the entire land. They, in effect, they just do Yericho, and they don't even spy out Yericho, they just go to the house of Rachav, from whence they do derive the information that they need. The question is, what brought the spies to the house of Rachav Hazona? If you contrast this with the first spying mission, they traversed the land. The Torah describes where they went, the different places of the land, and so forth, here they wind up in a place where you would not expect to find them. First of all, assuming if it is correct that Zona is to be taken literally, even though we see that there's ambivalence about that, we're going to try and resolve that ambivalence today. But why are they doing, what are they doing in this type of a place in an inn? They should be scouting, they should be hiding out in the fields or the forest, whatever it may be. And we do see that they got caught, which is also an interesting thing, and it's quite an unexpected thing. You don't expect them to get caught. Yeah. The instruction from Yeshua was to go to see the land. It's interesting, because even to see, what do you mean to see? It doesn't talk about spying out the land. It just says to see, which is a strange expression. What are you supposed to see? Ha'aretz v'es yericho. In point of fact, they never really got to see anything more than Yericho, and in point of fact, they didn't even get to see Yericho, because all they saw was this inn, which was on the wall. So that only strengthens the question. The Malbim says, Ha'aretz v'es yericho, means to say that the focus was really Yericho, and the Aretz would just mean the land surrounding it, which the essence over here is to see this Yericho. And the Aretz is not referring to the entire land. That's how he understands it. That makes a lot of sense, because the first point of attack was going to be Yericho. So the focus over here was Yericho, and apparently he was not interested in any extensive mission, which would fit in with what I said, that they had fully spied out the land 40 years before. And I'm sure they had the records of all the military information that had been returned. In terms of Rachav, Isha Zona, generally speaking, when the term Zona is used, it's meant to imply a harlot. That's Tamar, when she disguised herself, and on the road, it says about Yehuda, Vayachshever Lazona. And he thought that she was a harlot. Now, nobody is trying to exonerate him by implying that maybe she was a innkeeper over there. So that methodology is not being utilized. Here, the Tirgum Yonason, Rashi cites Tirgum Yonason, Pundakita. That Pundak, that someone is an innkeeper. Because the word Zona, the root is Zon. It's Parnasa, is sustenance, to sustain. So the word can be stretched to create that implication. What's the point of doing that, though? Why would they want to do that? Is the objective over here to sort of rescue the image of the spies? According to Chazal, they were not ordinary people. There was Pinchas, and there was Kale. That's according to Chazal. So Rashi over here says, Mocheres mine mezonos. That she sold different types of food. Okay. It's problematical, though, because if that is the case, if it's clear that this is a person who's an innkeeper and selling foods, a different term could have been selected. And therefore, why create any kind of an implication by using this term? The Radak says, Kamashma, plain meaning, which would mean a harlot. Oh, Mocheres Mazon. Or he says, it's also possible to say, someone who sold food, as Tirgum Yonatan. Then he adds something. He says, via MS Das Yonatan Zona Mamish. He's interpreting the intention of Yonatan. Yonatan really meant that she was a Zona. He didn't mean, by using the word Pundakita, he didn't mean to convey the idea that she was not a harlot. He says, Gichain Darko Bimkomos Litargem Zona Pundakis. Because that's the Tirgum. The Tirgum of the translation of the word itself is Pundakis. And he goes the end of the Radak. Vidaito, his understanding is Lafisha Azona Kapundakita. That is to say that he uses the word Pundakita not to tell you that she wasn't a Zona, but that's a very appropriate translation of the word Zona. Because she's similar to a Pundakita. Shemaf keres atzmalakol, that she makes herself available to everybody. So just like an open house kind of thing. So a restaurant or an inn, it has the same connotation. It's a place that's open to everybody. This this does not seem to be like Rashi, as we said. As we see that she was not an ordinary individual. She was a very unique kind of a person, and this story is most unexpected. Because as we know, their presence is discovered. And at that point in time, their fate was sealed. They would have been doomed. We don't understand exactly why it is that they were discovered. Was that some kind of mistake they made? And what happened over here? That's interesting in its own right. We'll take it up in a moment. But they were discovered and reported. Their presence was reported to the king. And the king then sent messengers. Let's go through the story a little bit. We'll get to the Rashi that I'm talking about. Just to review the story. It doesn't take long. They plan to spend the night there. Vayishkavu shama. That's in Pasuk Bet. They plan to stay overnight, to lodge there. Then it was told to the king of Jericho that men have come this night from the Bnei Yisrael. Lach poras aretz. So their ruse, whatever it was, didn't last very long. They were discovered. So the king of Jericho sent to Rachav to bring out these men who've come to you, to your house. Interesting kind of a situation. You wouldn't think that that's the way it would be done. It seems that she had a certain amount of importance over here because he's sending a messenger to her and communicating with her as opposed to just coming in. You think about these oppressive societies, the king with the secret police, they just barge in and where are the men? But they made the request of Rachav. So she must have been a very significant personality. Ki lach poras aretz bo. That is to say that they didn't accuse her of anything. They assumed that she didn't know. And they told her that they had come to spy out the land. Now, the next pasuk is interesting. So at this point in time, if you don't go any further, you figure they're finished, because why is Rachav going to endanger herself? She basically would comply and release the men. What does she have to gain? But the woman took the two men, Vatitzpano, and she hid him. We'll just briefly pause on this. This is a side point, because it's an interesting medrash. It says that the woman took the two men and hid him. Now, it should have been plural, hid them. But tits b'naim is what it should have said. So, Rashi explains that sometimes the pasuk will refer to two as though it were one, which means it's like a class. It's the spies. So it's one unit of spies. It's referring to the unit over here. Just like two witnesses is one aide. An aide, a witness has to be at least two people, but it's one unit. So she hid the unit. That's what it's referring to. However, and why is it doing that? Because it says that she hurried in hiding them, and she hid them in a narrow place. Ki'ilu haya yechidi, as though they were one. Well, this is pointing out her adeptness, that she was an adept kind of an individual. You see the way she responded. She didn't get flustered. And because she was in a very tough situation. She was putting her life on the line, obviously. This is treason. She was being traitorous. It's the worst thing you could possibly do, to aid and abet the enemy spies. But she had to react very, very quickly, and apparently that's part of her character, that she had the ability to act very quickly, and that's what the implication of a titzpano, as though it was one person. She was able to find the spot and get them out of sight. Now the Medrash Agada comes out of nowhere. Tanchuma, which says that Pinchas v'Kalev hayu, that these two spies were Pinchas and Kalev. Pinchas amad lefnehem v'lo ra'uhu lefi shehaya kamalach. And Pinchas stood before them and they didn't see him, because he was like an angel. I'm not saying that I understand this chazal. I'm just making the point that, especially when you're teaching people, any people, or especially children, it's not a good idea to teach this chazal unless you can explain it. If you can explain it, it's wonderful. But if you can't explain it, so you're leaving people with a notion that to them it's going to seem ridiculous. It's fables, making up stories, and so forth. It doesn't add anything. On a simple level of explanation, and I'm not saying that this is the full idea, because I don't think it is, but on a simple level of explanation, one can say that appeared like an angel would mean to say that it was Pinchas, and Pinchas had a different type of an appearance. He was a tremendous scholar, a Talmud Chacham, and he was an older, a sage. He's not the kind of person that you would expect to be a spy. So that it could be that he was one of the persons that were chosen, and his look, his natural look, was so far removed, something that nobody at all would associate. People have a certain association. Now, in most religions, you know, you develop a certain type of personality with a certain type of look. That person basically is not the kind of person who would be a spy. But that's not the Jewish idea. Because, you see, the greatest individuals, even though they're completely involved in the world of study and knowledge and kindness and compassion, but that's part of the greatness, is that when it's necessary, they can be the greatest warriors. So they can, like Avraham, fought the war against the mighty coalition. So that perhaps it means that he was not recognizable. His look, his natural look, was so far removed from anything that a person would associate with a spy, so that he didn't have to be hidden. That would be an attempt to put it in a rational frame. And they wouldn't have this knowledge. See, this type of a ruse would work for other people. This ruse would not work for somebody who was truly familiar with what really constitutes the Jewish ideal of the tzaddik. Because the tzaddik is one who's capable of undertaking a serious action, vengeful action. You see, Shmuel was upset with Shaul that he didn't dispose of Agag. So he took the knife and he cut him to pieces. That's not something you'd associate with Shmuel. One of the questions that does emerge pertaining to Rachav is, it is true that she did she saved the spies and she cooperated with them, but don't you have to raise the issue of treason? She was betraying her own people. But let's continue. What does she do? Look how bright she is. After she hides them, she has to deal with them. And she said, yes, the men have come to me. V'lo yadati me'ayin hema, but I don't know where they come from. So she didn't know that they were Jews. Fine. But what does that indicate, that she doesn't know that they were Jews? See, all this is giving us a little bit of information about the kind of place that she ran. She's duplicitous. No question about it. She's lying. The whole thing here is lies. But it does indicate that this was not, even if you say she was a harlot, it was not an ordinary house of prostitution. This is a woman of tremendous significance. The king sent messengers to her. The king treated her with a certain dignity and respect. And pretty much you have to assume it was the kind of place where people would gather. Maybe more like a nightclub kind of a thing. And people, it was right by the border. Right by the border, and that's where, for example, in World War II, in neutral countries, or countries like Turkey or Switzerland, that were sort of neutral, so it would be a good place to get information. Because all the diplomats, the people that would come, even you'd have diplomats from the both sides, from the Allies and from the Axis, from the other side. And there were certain types of places where you could eat, where you could drink, and where you could indulge in other vices, that type of an environment. Now, that type of an environment is a good place to go to pick up information. The truth of the matter, in general, if you want to get a sense of what people are really thinking, a bar, I'm not saying you should go to bars, but a bar, a club, that kind of place is good, because people, when they go there, they're in the mood, they're in a relaxed kind of a mood, and all the defenses come down. That's where people go to relax after a hard day's work, and they have a few drinks, and their defenses are down, and that's where they'll say a lot of things in an unguarded way. That's the kind of place that I believe it was. It was more, it was sophisticated. I guess today we would use the word upscale. Was the kind of, that's probably why they went there, because they were not searching for the kind of information that would be, you know, the physical, the fortifications and things of that sort. They were searching for a different kind of intelligence, as we'll soon find out. And as soon as they received that intelligence, their mission was complete. So that's why she was in a very good position, because many people come. People from all different countries, when they would come, that's where they would stay. So, yeah, men have come, but I don't know where they came from. That's fine. And then she said that, now she makes up an excuse. She goes beyond just defending herself. You see, she's very proactive. But she's trying to create the conditions which would facilitate their escape. She's really thinking ahead. What she does over here now is to set up conditions, we'll see as the story develops, which makes it possible for them to escape. She wanted them to be safe, not just for the moment, but to assure their escape. That's a higher degree of insight and wisdom and courage. It takes a tremendous amount of courage. So she said that at the time when the gate was closing, in the darkness, that is, the men waited until dark, when the gates were about to close. And the men left. So this creates the impression that they were going back. She didn't say, she was in a bit of a tough situation. She couldn't say that she knew too much, because if you know too much, that's going to incriminate you. You must have spoken to them. So she's just hinting. Now the fact that, look how brilliantly she does it. The fact is they left the gates at night, they would lock the gates, because they were in a very heightened state of alert. So when did the men leave? Just about the time that they would lock the gates. So that indicates that they wanted to escape. That creates the impression that they're going to escape. But she doesn't know where they're going, because how would you know where they're going unless they told you? So she says, Lo yadati anaholchu hanashim. I don't know where the men have gone. All I know is that this is how they acted. So she's creating an impression. Now listen to this. Ritfu maher achareihem. Run after them very quickly, kisasigum, that you'll catch them. So she sent them on a wild goose chase. But her objective was, of course, to save them, but then to get rid of the men. Not just to get rid of the men, but to put the men in a certain psychological framework. So she's urging them. This is the situation. They just left, and I don't know where they've gone. So chase after them. The implication is they're going back towards their base. If they're going back towards their base, then the men are going to be headed towards the Yarden. Because everybody knew that the Jews were on the other side of the Jordan. So Ritfu Meir, she's urging them to get moving. Then it says that she brought them up to the roof, and she hid them in the stalks of flax that were set out on the roof. Okay, so now we know where the men are. The men are on the roof, and they're hidden. Then it goes back and tells us what happened to these messengers. The king's messengers chased after them towards the Yarden, Al-Hamabros, and the crossings. There were places where you could cross the Jordan, where the water is not that high. And the gate was closed after them when the pursuers ran out after them. So basically she established the situation that for the time being they were safe. And she knew where the king's men would be going. Okay. That's part one. Part one, and of course, put yourself in the situation of the spies. I don't know that at this point in time they have any idea what's going on. But there's been something that was unforeseen. Now she goes up to the roof. And before they had gone to sleep, she went to the roof. And she says to the men, now this is very, very crucial. She has to give an explanation of her behavior. And I'm asking this question before we read this. It's true that she did a wonderful thing. Put yourself in this situation. She did a very nice thing in saving your life and in misdirecting the messengers and all of that. But just because she saved your life, does that mean that she's a wonderful person? Does that make her a righteous person? Because you do have the question. The question I'm posing is, a person can look at this from a different angle and say that she did it for totally selfish purposes, as we do see. Her objective was, of course, to save her own life. But not only her own life, she wants to save the entire family. That's that she makes a deal with them. And they accept it. However, and the one can even ask that question, what right do they have to make such a guarantee? For there was a mitzvah. The mitzvah over here was to wage a war. And we'll soon see that this was not an ordinary war, but it's a war that to utterly destroy the seven nations. It's pretty similar to the war against Amalek. And they made a decision to spare her. But aside from that, isn't it possible to look at this as self-serving? If you look at it as self-serving, then this could be the one of the worst types of behaviors. That is, a person who turns against their own people. A spy, a traitor, who turns against their own people. Now, it's true, as we know, that she thought that the situation was hopeless. But just because you think the situation is hopeless, does that make it correct for you to turn against your own people? That's what we're going to try and understand. Now we're taking Pasuk Tes. She said to the men, Yadati. Listen to the words. Each word has great significance. I know. Ki nasan ar Hashem lachem es ha'aretz. That God has given you this land. V'chi nafla emaschem aleinu. And that the awe of you has fallen upon us. Aleinu, upon us. That means not just me, but the entire people have a certain attitude towards you, a certain awe. V'chi namogu kol yoshvei ha'aretz mibneichem. And all of this is a reference to the spirit. The spirit, so to speak, has dissolved. So what is the difference? Ema means that there's a certain attitude. You look up to a certain person. Just because you look up to a certain person and you fear a certain person, that doesn't mean to say that you're not able or capable of mounting some type of a battle. Namogu is a further extent. That is, it's the attitude is such that their spirit, they're lacking the spirit to stand up against you. That's the first thing. Ki shamanu, for we have heard. Eish ha-shehovish ar-Hashem es mei yamsuf mibneichem. That God dried the waters of the Yamsuf before you. Basically, what she's saying is, we've heard about the miracle of the Kriyas Yamsuf. B'tseischem mi-Mitzrayim, when you left Egypt. So now she shows a familiarity with the history. Basically, that's what it says in the Torah, that the entire world knew about what took place. In fact, it says in the Shira, Namogu kol yoshvei Kanaan, the exact same word. That all the inhabitants of Canaan, when they hear about this, will be filled with a fear, affrighted. V'asher asisem l'shnei malchei ha'amori, and what you did to the two kings of Amori, asher be'evar ha'yarden, on the other side of the Yarden, l'sichon u'liog, asher hecharamtem osam, that you destroyed them. So now she's, part two, she's explaining what the basis is. Two historical events. Two things have we heard. So it's important for us to explain. These two are important. What's the difference between one and two? Well, one would seem to be sufficient. We heard the miracle of the Kriyas Yamsuf. But she doesn't stop at that. She also mentions something which is recent. Which is more recent. That's 40 years ago. Is the miracle of the Yamsuf. This has just taken place. The defeat of Sichon and Og. Vanishma, and we heard. keeps repeating the word Vanishma. What is the significance of the word Vanishma we heard? It doesn't just mean we heard the news. The word Vayishma is used in a different sense. It's in the sense of Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Achad, hear, O Israel. The term Shema, in that sense, doesn't mean just to listen, just to hear audible sounds. But Shema means to listen and to understand, to internalize the idea. Where do you see an example of that? In the Torah? Naseh v'nishma, Shema Yisrael, Naseh v'nishma, very good. Naseh we will do, v'nishma we will listen. You can't say it means we'll listen because we already have to listen, otherwise we couldn't do. But there it means we'll understand. Vayishma Yisrael. In the same situation, this is the equivalent to Yisrael. Because the Chazal keep asking, Mashmua Shama Oba, what Shmua did he hear and come? What made Yisrael different? The whole world heard. It says Vayishma Yisrael. The implication is that only he heard. No, but it means to say that it's an amazing thing. The tremendous events take place. The whole world heard about the Kriyas Yamsa, but only a few people really heard the message, the idea that to internalize, a person can go through his entire life being cognizant about significant events. Significant events take place, and how many people are affected by it in terms of thinking it through and learning the lesson and acting upon it? That's what the greatness of Yisrael. He didn't hear anything different than millions of people heard. Vayishma means, for the rest of them, it wasn't a real hearing. That's what she's saying over here. Vanishma means that we heard, and this was a hearing that had a tremendous impact upon everybody. It's a different kind of a hearing. Vayimas levavenu. Now, this is a much more stark expression. Our hearts melted. That is to say that the spirit, v'lo kama od ruach ba'ish b'bneichem, and no man had any spirit left to stand up. The spirit we're talking about is a spirit of self-confidence, is a spirit of resistance. Okay, so now she's describing the state of affairs. In this statement, I have to mention it because it pertains to what we said before as to whether she was a zona, whether she was a harlot or not. There is a sexual innuendo here. There's a sexual implication, which Rashi refers to. I'm only bringing it up because of the bearing that it has upon that issue. We'll get to it in a second. The first use of the word shama, in Pasuk Yud, where it says, Kishamanu Eisasher Hovish, we heard about the Red Sea. There it can mean, in a simple sense, we got the news. You don't have to read anything deeper into that. Now the question is, though, what kind of a hearing was it? Was it superficial or in-depth? Well, in Pasuk 11, where it says, Vanishma Vayimas Levavenu, that we heard and our hearts melted, there it's clear that it's that she is saying that she understood the full implications. Now, what is the conclusion? Why were the hearts melted? Ki Hashem Elokeichem hu Elokim b'shamayim imal v'yahal ha'aretz mitochas. That's the key. The key to understanding the story of Rachav and the fact that she was not regarded as a traitor. And bear in mind, if she was a traitor, if she was an opportunist, I don't know if the spies would have given the guarantee that they did, or would have been bound by it. Because just because, it's an interesting thing, just because you're the beneficiary of something, if someone is a traitor, is a turncoat to their own country, and they give you the information that you need, so you're happy because it saves you, it helps you, but will that give you a higher opinion? Let's say an Arab, because of purely selfish considerations, will provide important material information that will save Jews from a bombing or something like that. But he doesn't care at all about saving Jewish life. He was motivated purely by selfish motives. And he sold out his own family, whatever. And they were caught and they were killed. So you benefited from it. Now, would you have respect for this person? Would you look at this person any differently? Well, maybe emotionally you'd feel something towards that person, but in reality, no. This person is a wicked person, an evil person, but the world is made up in such a way that sometimes you can benefit from that. So that's what I'm trying to say, that here, the fact that she saved them is not enough. She understood that. And she's explaining over here the real motivation for the way she's acting. The real motivation for the way she's acting is true. The situation is hopeless. And there's no way that we can fight against you. But as a result of everything she's learned, all the things that she's been told, and of course Tanakh can't go into all the particulars. It's not just because you hear some news, and she must have given it a great deal of thought. She was obviously a very intelligent woman. She's gone through a tremendous process, and she's come to a recognition of what the source of your strength truly is. The source of your strength is the fact that you are the people of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of God. She understands all the fundamentals of Yahadus. Of course, you know Chazal say that she converted, and she married no less a figure than Yahushua. And Nevi'im, Yirmiyahu was a descendant. Great people, according to Chazal, issued forth from her. But here you see, but it's an amazing thing. If that's the case, is it possible to say that such greatness emanated from someone who originally was his owner? That's what we're going to try and understand. There seems to be a bit of a disparity on that. Rachav was a person, therefore, who had, as a result of all these events that she had heard about, and apparently she gave it a great deal of thought and study, and that's not being described to us. But she did have an opportunity to meet many, many people. And she came to the realization that the Jews were a unique people, and that God has given them this land. That's what she said. This land belongs to you because God has given it to you. But even as she continues, so now she has to effectuate. She wants to achieve something out of this. She wants to save her life and her family. So how does she go about it? The Ata, and now, Hishavu no li b'Hashem, to swear to me by God. Apparently she knew a great deal at this point about the Judaism, certain aspects of Judaism. How significant an oath. How could she guarantee her safety? How could she guarantee the safety of her family? She understood what these men were about, to take a shvuah, to take an oath by God. Because once you incorporate God into the oath, it's a very, very significant thing. Ki asisi imachem chesed, because I did chesed with you. I performed chesed. Vasisem gam atem im beis avi chesed, and you should also do with my family, my father's house, chesed. Unesatem li os emes, and give me a sign. Give me a true, reliable, MS over here, reliable, authentic guarantee, a sign, a simon, Matsuda says. Continue, in verse 13, because we're trying to understand now what she was entitled to. As a result of what she had done for them, was she automatically entitled that she should be spared? Was she entitled that she should be spared, but her family was not necessarily entitled, and that would be a favor? Or was she entitled even to that she and her family should be spared? This is a very delicate issue. She says, "V'chayisem es avi v'yas imi." This is part of her request. And you'll save my father and my mother. V'yas achai v'yas achyosai. And my brothers and sisters v'yas kol ha'shelahem. And everything that's theirs, I assume means their children for sure, their property, whatever. V'itzaltem es nafshoseinu mimavis, and that you will save our souls. So that's her request. It's for herself, but she's including pretty specifically her parents, siblings, and everything that's theirs, I guess, if they're married, so their spouses, the whole thing. Similar to Lot and his daughters and their husbands if were invited to be saved. Vayomru loha anashim, and the men said to her, Nashenu tachtechem lamos. All right, we're putting our lives in the line. We'll die. If, that is to say, that we agree, we'll keep the deal, and if to the extent that we'll forfeit our lives. if we don't keep the promise. Im lo sagidu es dvareinu zeh. If you don't reveal this, if you keep it a secret, they were going to establish terms with her. They were prepared to respond to her and to accede to her request on the basis of certain terms, but one of the absolute conditions was that she couldn't tell anybody. It had to be a secret. And it will be when God will give us the land, and we will do towards you chesed v'emes. Chesed and emes. Compassion and truth. The Radak quotes the classical pshat, that there are two things, chesed and emes. There's a difference between the two. There are certain things that you do for another person because of an obligation, not because of chesed. That's basically what determines it. As the Radak says, that chesed is the good that a person does for someone else who has no claim against them. It's optional, it's voluntary. So he says, let's analyze the story. She acted towards them with chesed. She did chesed for them. They had no claim on her in hiding them. Kihem lo gomlu atova adheno, because they hadn't done any good for her until now. To the contrary, they had, in a certain sense, jeopardized her. But certainly they hadn't done anything for her, so she didn't owe them anything. And therefore she did them a good, a tov. Lefichach amr lahem, therefore she said to them, Vasisem gamaten in base avi chesed. That's why she used the term chesed, because what she was asking for was chesed. She was asking for a favor for her family. V'lo amra imi. She didn't say, you'll do with me chesed. Because as far as she was concerned, whatever they would do for her would not be chesed. Ki bach yosam osa, because in agreeing to keep her alive, hu emes, that is emes, it's truth, v'chova aleihem, it was obligatory upon them to do that. Ki hi hachisam osa. Because she kept them alive. He's making a very interesting distinction, a very fine distinction. And that is to say that they were confronted with two situations, what they would do with regard to her. That's one framework. One framework. What they would do with regard to her a family would be a different framework. That is to say, if all things being equal, apparently it would seem, according to this, that even if she had not made the request, they would have saved her. We don't know how they would have reacted because, in point of fact, she had a request to make. So we only see them reacting to her request. But let's say she would not have requested for the family. Let's say she had no family. According to this, they would have had to save her. So thus, saving her was obligatory, according to the Radak, the way he reads the Psukim. However, she wanted something. She wanted a favor. This is to be regarded as a favor. Apparently, they were under no obligation to do anything for the sake of her family. That's why, it fits in beautifully with the words. She's saying, she's asking to do something for the father's house, which would be chesed, because they didn't do anything for them. So the spies didn't know anything to her family. And thus, she was asking for chesed. Uvach yosam beis avia, but in saving her family, hu chesed. That was chesed. Lefichach amru la heim gam kein. That's why when they, in their response, when they said, as long as you keep this a secret, that was of great importance to be kept a secret, v'yasinu imach, we will do with you, chesed ve'emes. They mentioned both things. Emes lach yosa, the emes was to sustain her life, v'chesed lahachios beis avia. And the chesed would be for the sake of the family. Now, before we analyze it, os emes, the sign that she wanted. Ha'os shetitnu li, the sign that you'll give to me, shetekainu oso, v'yal techazvu bi. An os emes means something which would be authentic, true, firm. I would say that what she requested by the os emes which seems to be not that significant over here, because what's significant is that they gave their word, and so ultimately they kept it. Why is Yisrael concerned with the sign? And how is that going to help? Whatever the sign is, if they're not trustworthy people, what good is it? I think it means that she wanted, a lot of times, you agree to things under stress, under duress, and you don't have time to think it through. So, if you don't think it out clearly, you could give a certain kind of a sign, but if it's not clearly thought out, then it could become blurred, it could be confused, or it could be one that is not good enough. The sign had to be something which was absolutely clear. You see that they're very concerned later on about this, not letting other people know about this. So she wanted them to think about it, to take it seriously, and to come up with something which was clear, which would not lend itself to confusion, and later on could say, well, I thought it was this way, I thought it was that way. That's the oath, Anas. You see? They could have said something else which would not have been as firm, or not have been as immune to deception, or to rationalization is the word I'm looking for. You find the expression of chesed ve'emes coming together in a lot of places. For example, you have it in Vayichi, that's in Bereishis. That's in the end of chapter 47, where Yaakov calls Yosef, and he has him take an oath. And this is what he says, V'yosiso imodi chesed ve'emes, and you will do with me chesed and emes. The two are together over here. Al nosik v'reni v'mitzrayim. He's asking him for a chesed, which sounds like a favor, but emes, which is true. Now, on the surface, I mean, if it's true, if true means justice, so then it's not chesed. And if it's chesed, so then it's not justice. But nevertheless, he's combining the two, and the request is that when he dies, that he should remove him from Egypt and to bury him with his fathers. So you do see that expression. You also see it when Yaakov is leaving, and after the dream with the ladder going to heaven, and he prays to God, and he says, Katonti, I am too insignificant, too small, mikol hachasadim, from all of the acts of chesed, of compassion, umikol ha'emes, and from all the truth. Now there, it's a little bit separated, but it's the same concept. These two ideas seem to go together. Chesed and emes. The way I understand it, there are two points over here. There's two requests. Of course, there's one issue of saving Rachel. And then there's the issue of saving the family. The difference between the two is that Rachel deserved to be saved. She deserved to be saved for what she had done. And of course, it's not just simply for what she has done. As we said, there's another element. She could have done that same thing, and it could have been a favor, but it doesn't mean that it would have been MS, that it would have been true, because had she acted from the wrong motives, self-serving motives, had she been a traitor to her own people, and was just interested in saving herself because she believed that everything was hopeless, then it would not have been MS. It would not have been truth. The other group that she was talking about was undeserving. We didn't know if they were good people, we didn't know if they were bad people, but they certainly had no connection to this thing. There was nothing, as far as they were concerned, that would render them to be deserving of being saved. She was deserving of being saved, they were not deserving of being saved. Now, if that is the case, what was the situation as far as the spies were concerned? Were the spies obligated to save her? I would say the answer is yes, from a chesed point of view, from the framework of chesed, yes. The fact that it's MS, the fact that it's true, there's different kinds of chesed that you do. There's a chesed which is not necessarily MS, and we're not always in a position to be able to do chesed of MS. I don't remember exactly, I think this is from the idea I'm going to mention. I think it's from the Rav, Zichron Levracha. It says in the Shemona Esrei that God is Gomel, Chasadim, Tovim. that God does for us, acts of chesed which are good, goodly. And the question arises, it's chesed, of course it's good. What's bringing chesedim tovim as opposed to what? Chesedim ra'im, bad chesed? What's bad chesed? So I believe it's, I heard this years ago, and I think it's from the Rav, that is to differentiate between human chesed and divine chesed. We are very limited. We do something which is a good for another person, it's only, we imagine it to be a good. We never know for sure. You help a person out, you give a person money, or you do something for a person. How do you know that you're really doing the right thing? Maybe in this situation, the person would have been better off without that thing, without that effort, without that entity, whatever it is. Sometimes you'll see a situation like that, where the parents would have been stronger and left the kid on his own and not helped him out of the bind, the person would have been better off. You don't know. We really are very limited. In terms of the objective content of what we're doing, whether it's really beneficial, that we don't know. But in our framework, God demands that we do chesed. So we have to do chesed according to how it appears to us. Person is hungry, starving, this, that, we can't say, well, maybe if we left him alone, he'd finally get so fed up, he'd get over his laziness and get a job. You don't have a right to say that. You got to deal with the situation as it appears. But divine chesed is tov. That's the gomel chesed. When God does chesed, it's tov. So there's two kinds of chesed. There's a chesed that partakes of tov, and over here I would say partakes of MS. That it's in line with MS. It's true. There's truth. But just because it's true, just because you're deserving, and just because this situation would be beneficial, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not chesed. So if you were fortunate enough to come into a situation which was in line with what you needed and you worked for it and you deserved it, just because you deserve something doesn't mean you're going to get it the way this world is set up. It's still chesed. A lot of people have the idea in their own mind, no, I'm entitled to it. And because they believe that they're entitled to certain things, they take a lot of things for granted, and that impedes upon something called hakaras hatov. Very often it's with children and parents have that type of thing. It's very hard for children often to recognize the hakaras hatov to parents because they just assume that they're entitled to everything. And they're not. Parents have certain obligations, but beyond that it's chesed. But the sense of entitlement, because you think it's MS, you don't want to look at it as chesed. But there's no contradiction between chesed and emes. It can be both. So I believe that when they spoke to her, they said, V'yosinu imach, we will do with you chesed ve'emes. Thus, saying that whatever they would do with her would be on this basis. We've analyzed, we've heard your story, we know that you're not a traitor. We know that you're a unique individual, that you've been able to extricate yourself from all of these attachments, very powerful attachments, to loyalty to one's country and background, and to think the matter through, and to have this recognition, and this willingness to put your life in jeopardy, not for personal gain, because this is the truth. You want to do something which is in line with the will of God. That's what you wanted to do. That's MS. But it's chesed. It's chesed because if you're going to look at it from the strict sense of the term, in terms of are we obligated? Do we have a legal obligation to do that? The failure to do it, of course it would be wrong not to do it, but it would be a failure of chesed. Which is to say that if you did somebody a favor, and then you come to them and you need a favor, are they obligated to do it for you? The obligation would only be from the sense of chesed, from the sense of it would be a lack of a karas hatov and so on and so forth if you fail to do it because this person helped you out. But the nature of it is not obligatory. It's not an obligation. It's still voluntary. It's still in the framework of chesed. And a person should always remember that. That is to say, according to you, if you did a favor for a person, now you come back and you need on the same level of favor. Let's put it on the same level. We'll keep it on the same level. If that person does it for you, do you have to thank them? Do you have to show your appreciation? If you're telling me that you didn't do me a favor, you had to do it, it was an obligation, then you really don't have to thank them, technically speaking. But that's not the way it works. You appreciate it, and you'll send them a thank you note for being so nice and being so kind and being so... And you didn't have to do it, because the truth of the matter is, on one hand, you had to do it. On the other level, you didn't have to do it. It doesn't detract from the factor of chesed. The fact that something is emes doesn't mean that it's not in the realm of human behavior, which is called chesed. So what I think is feasible is that everything they did was chesed over here. But there was a difference in the... I'm not arguing with the commentaries and all that. There was a difference in terms of the chesed that was displayed towards her and the chesed that was displayed towards the family. That was something else. That was pure chesed. That wasn't emes. There was no emes involved. There was no obligation to go any further and to save the family. That was a new expression of chesed, which was based upon the fact that they saw that she was an individual who was worthy of that kind of chesed. The chesed of saving a life was an emes. That was emes. Why wouldn't you do it? She saved your life. She put herself at risk and did so for the correct motivations. All right, so you can walk away from the situation. No deals were made. She didn't come to them before she did this and say, I'll save your life if you do such and such. She did it because it was the right thing to do. Afterwards, she makes the request. So therefore, as far as she is concerned, it falls under the heading of chesed. They could have said, look, you never said we have to do that. You went ahead, you were nice, you saved our lives. But you didn't elicit from us a corresponding requirement, so we're not under any bond here. We didn't give our word. Did not give our word. Oh, you're talking about being a nice guy? You're talking about chesed. That's something else. It's chesed. It's chesed and it's emes with regard to her. But when they looked into her character and they saw what her real nature was, the question arises, is she deserving of a chesed which is beyond the chesed shel emes? Which is something that's purely for her benefit because it's her family. There was no objective requirement that they be saved. Because we don't have to assume that they were tzaddikim like her. If they were tzaddikim like her, that's a different story. But they're not. It's just this is my family. My brothers, my sisters, my parents. I want to see them saved. So I'm asking you, that was a pure favor and did not partake of the MS aspect. That's what they responded to. That because she was a unique individual, she was deserving of a different kind of chesed. And that's an interesting phenomenon. That a person, we always find ourselves in these situations. Because people are always asking, we're always asking people to do things for us, and people are always needing us. We're always in those situations where people need things. It's chesed. So when a situation of chesed comes your way and you have to think about it, the first issue, I suppose, is what's the MS factors over here? Look at the MS. Look at the past. That's very important because very often you tend to forget. Very often you tend to forget, you tend to dismiss, because you don't feel like doing it. And you don't realize that about a month ago, this person went out of the way for you. That's forgotten. Or that's downplayed. Usually it's downplayed. That's the MS chart. You should have an MS chart which you review. And the MS chart may be very, very surprising to you. It's not what your immediate instinctive reaction is. Very often the immediate instinctive reaction is, oh, I'm busy, this and that, it's just an annoyance and a bother, and why should I? Then you start to think of things that this person did for you. One second. That's the first consideration. If it's a chesed shel emes, so then if there's emes there, then it puts it in a different light. And obviously, if you can do it, you can't always do it. You can't always do a chesed. These men were in a situation, maybe they couldn't do it. There were a lot of complications over here. a lot of complexities. But the secrecy of the matter, it being discovered, whether they'd be able to carry it through, a lot of issues over here. There's no guarantee in a situation of war that they'd be able to fulfill the promise. But then there's another issue. Let's say it's not the MS factor. It's not there. Let's say there's no MS. There's no real obligatory factor. Then, of course, you want to look at the person. Is this person someone who's deserving of this kind of a chesed? And that's what they decided, that she was the individual who was deserving of receiving this type of benefit for those people, for a family who in and of themselves were not deserving. So their salvation did not come about as a result of the MS factor. It came purely as a result of the chesed factor.